Dr. Bassam Haddad was not here when I was welcoming our other two, and I just want to welcome him this morning. Bassam, give you the microphone.
Every time I talk about Syria, the ambassador happens to be in the room. So I just ask him not to be upset with me. Thank you all for being here. Thanks for the invitation and giving me the opportunity to address this distinguished audience. My talk is titled, I'm going to try to squeeze it into a smaller number of minutes. It's called U.S. Syria Lebanon, Between Beating a Really Dead Horse and the Hard Place, by Bassam Haddad. I'm reading what's in front of me right now. I'm going to stick to the text so that I don't go on many tangents. So I apologize for reading from my notes. It is difficult to characterize the United States' relations with Lebanon and Syria over the past two decades, together or separately. The United States and its various tentacles have supported and criticized, as well as attacked, both countries in the previous three decades. The latest attack on Syrian soil was only a few days ago. The meddling in Lebanese politics and toying with those of Syria stretches back to the 1950s. Accordingly, successive U.S. administrations have duly been praised, maligned, and/or ignored. There is no indication that stable relations will ensue with either country, not least because any new administration is likely to bring its own interpretive lenses into the mix. As is the case with U.S. policy in the Middle East in general, its relations with Syria and Lebanon suffer from recurring shortfalls, which I'll be discussing in a minute, so much so that analysts of all persuasions find common ground in addressing some shortcomings. I wish I could sit here and pretend that I would be presenting observations that are earth-shattering or even novel in any way. When it comes to U.S. policy in the Middle East, the unpleasant aroma, whether moral or analytical, that is effused in the 1980s, 90s, and today is very familiar to the trained and untrained observer, so much so that rarely do you see U.S. Middle East policymakers continue to take seriously or take pride in the politics or policies they formulated after leaving office. It's a tough lose-lose job that someone has to do until the next administration or team comes along. What changes are the costs under differing circumstances? Today, as ever, we bear witness to inconsistencies in policymaking, U.S. policymaking, and one step forward, two steps back course of actions. We want democracy, but we don't like the winners. We want pluralism, but we don't want everyone represented. We want regime change in Syria, but don't like the Islamist alternative. We want Hariri, but not the Sunni radical supporters in the north. We want a democratic Lebanon, but not the vote of the plurality of Shiites. The last and best of all, at times, we want stability without balance of power, a concept that we'd like to do away with after the collapse of the Soviet Union. However you look at U.S. policy in Lebanon and Syria, you'll have to work hard to avoid the following undramatic observations. U.S. policy in SNL, short for Syria and Lebanon, not Saturday Night Live, U.S. policy in SNL suffers from an absence of long view that is not overdetermined by immediate political concerns. This is also very much a function of how the American political system operates and is structured, and that's not the subject of discussion here, at least. It suffers from, secondly, an absence of a truly independent foreign policy team capacity that is able to shake off special interests, all special interests. The idea here is that special interests not only do not always comport with the national interest, but they sometimes drag the country into costly policies and wars. Third, and finally, after 9/11, and I'm restricting my comments to three here, after 9/11/2001, both the insecurity and arrogance of U.S. policymaking in the Middle East have made for an all-new approach that invites delusion, whether it is the blind and an unaccountable support of a pro-Hariri government in Lebanon, to a war to eradicate the most popular movement in Lebanon, to strikes against and inside Syria by our allies or our own military forces, the U.S. foreign policy team has outdone itself with nothing to show for it except an increase in anti-U.S. government hostility in the two countries and beyond among Islamists and secularists alike, including Waleed Jimblat. That's supposed to be a joke. Okay. For those who know Waleed Jimblat. It is a rather simple task to point out the shortcomings and raise problems when it comes to U.S. Middle East policy. It is more difficult to talk about finding solutions, and it's yet more difficult to actually apply them. I'm going to skip a discussion that borders on an IR or international relations approach or digression, and I will go right to how do we proceed, how to proceed, what kind of suggestions we can put on the table, given that, well, since I started learning about the Middle East in the earlier and mid-1980s and studying the Middle East, I've been hearing the same exact criticisms. Things changed in the rest of the world, in Latin America, Sub-Saharan Africa, Southeast Asia, Southern Europe, Eastern Europe, after the collapse of the Soviet Union. But when it came to the Middle East, we find a continuity that is remarkable and remarkably problematic. Power relations again, among the actors involved prejudice for a starting point that privileges the United States, if only because its policies are more consequential. Neither are Lebanese policies going to affect the other players. Sometimes they don't affect most Lebanese, nor are the Syrians able to affect the behavior of other states, stronger states. Within 2 years, the sovereignty of Syria has been directly and violently violated at least twice, once by Israel and once by the United States. And the Syrian regime was hardly able to do or say more than, quote, "The next time this happens, we deserve the right to retaliate." Here are some basic negative suggestions for U.S. policymakers working on Lebanon and Syria in the context of the war on terrorism, the Iraq war, the Iranian situation, and the Arab-Israeli conflict. I'm making negative suggestions because positive ones like apply your principles or support international law overseas, let alone serve justice, will not be heeded for obvious reasons in international politics. First, this is going to sound quite arrogant, considering that I was critiquing the arrogance of U.S. foreign policy. But first, do not take your own classification of terrorist organizations and state sponsors of terror too seriously in your policies, because most actors around the world don't take them seriously. They take their problematic and violent consequences seriously, but not their designation. If one studies the history of classifying organizations and groups as terrorists in the United States, you'll realize why U.S. policymakers themselves don't take them seriously. It's a very politicized process. If this worked to mobilize this country to invade and occupy Iraq, it will not work anymore, absent another attack on U.S. soil. Another point stems from this first one. Do not try to eliminate or eradicate mass movements that represent a plurality of any country, including the Lebanese or Lebanon, on grounds that they are terroristic. This works on Fox News, but not in the real world. Do not assume you can effectively establish a new favorable balance of power in the region or a stable Iraq without the support of the Syrian and Iranian regimes as they stand. Clearly, that's why there was talk of a regime change in Syria a couple of years ago, but the Israelis warned of an Islamist alternative, so we dropped that prospect. And clearly, this is why we want a different or a weaker regime in Iran via a military strike of sorts. In other words, absent some dramatic unforeseen development or regional war, you have to talk to the Syrians and the Iranians at some point. A subsidiary point here, do not continue to strike Syria or support striking Syria if you expect to have stability in Iraq, especially when Syria is resuming relations with the rest of the world and is emerging out of its isolation stint since 2005, with talks with the European Union, France, Britain, China, Russia, and beyond. Third, Do not meddle in the internal politics of these regimes because you have a new world order created by the United States where alliance with the United States is your ally's strongest liability within those countries. In Syria, most secular anti-Islamist and anti-Syrian regime activists, the opposition that is secular, that is anti-Islamist, are most scared of being associated with an arrogant, aggressive, and unprincipled United States in their effort to shake off the regime's authoritarian practices domestically. In Lebanon, the U.S. unequivocal support to the Hariri camp weakened that camp by first inflating the value of that support, only to see it deflate as circumstances on the ground proved inhospitable for U.S. meddling of any sort. In fact, this one-sided U.S. support of any group in Lebanon is more likely to ignite or reignite civil war than to serve the interest of any party involved. And fourth, my personal favorite, which no one likes, do not assume the Syrian regime is sincerely interested in peace with Israel, absent some comprehensive plan that includes the Palestinians. And this is not necessarily about solidarity with Palestinians, but irrational preference on part of the Syrian regime, given the opportunity cost of unnecessary peace to domestic regime interest in Syria. The derivative of this is, no matter how many pundits see an opportunity on the Syrian-Israeli peace track, don't go for it wholeheartedly without having made strides on the Israeli-Palestinian track. The gaze of the Syrian regime is in that direction, because it will accept being second last only when the game nears an end, not before. Most importantly, this is the last comment, stop listening to think tanks and token Arab intellectuals that staff some of them when they tell you, we know how this or that society works, or how these people think, and what will or will not work with them. You are being taken on an expensive and costly, often irreversible ride. Best to stick to basic principles of balance of power that are analytically and morally mediocre, but would control damage and reduce irreversible courses of action, and ultimately allow future generation in the region the opportunity to produce seriously sound policies under different circumstances. So to U.S. Middle East policymakers, this is not your day. It hasn't been for a while. So go for the suboptimal, you might get somewhere, and there will still be allies with local legitimacy that might still respect you and the U.S. government. If you go all the way, or go all the way, and you'll find that, progressively, the only weapon you have is force, and that is a sure sign of an impending grand fall. Thank you.